I knew something had happened.
You see the man.
I fell to the ground and I think I yelled, I'm hit, I'm down, need help, but no one could help you because everyone is down and no one could get up, no one could get to you. My first thought was my wife and kids. For a lot of Jews in Australia, the gravity and the jarringness of the attack was obviously very shocking, but it wasn't surprising in many ways. I can't explain to you why I survived, but a 10-year-old girl did not, or an 87-year-old Holocaust survivor who saw the horrors of the Shoah is not here. When this hatred goes unchecked, when it's mainstream, when it's legitimized, when it's excused, that violence will follow. And you saw this deadly manifestation on December 14th.
Hey, Lav, it's good to see you.
You too. A lot of news in the last week.
I loved it in the last week. I think you were actually supposed to be in the U.S., but snow prevented that from happening.
Yes. I was speaking tour this week, mostly in the South. And you think like the South is safe in winter, except that they're now experiencing their biggest snowstorm in 20 years. So all of the stops on my speaking tour, except for one, canceled. And so the tour is not happening. But hopefully we'll be able to reschedule in the future.
Well, I'm glad that you're here on the podcast with us. We have a very special guest, Arsen Ostrovsky, who shares his deeply moving personal story and the tragedy from the Bondi Beach terror attack and the lessons that he's learned and that he thinks that Australia and the world has to learn from that attack. But before we get to Arsen, a lot of the action this past week was taking place at Davos, where President Trump and Jared Kushner, Steve Witkoff, they unveiled the Board of Peace. We got more insight and more details about what that's actually going to look like. Lav, what's your take on that?
I guess we should talk a little bit about what the plan is, which the idea is that Hamas would give up all of its like major weapons and details of the tunnels so that the tunnels could be destroyed. And any like hand weapons, like any rifles and handguns and things like that, would have to be turned into the police. And the police would be run by this new Palestinian technocratic committee, which had been announced, I guess it's a week and a half ago now. But it is based on sort of a somewhat voluntary base, like not voluntary, right? They say if Hamas doesn't demilitarize, then, you know, Trump threatens them and he says we could do it the easy way or the hard way, etc. But his whole plan is sort of built on this happening. And then the idea is to just really develop Gaza, build a lot of homes, have a lot of business opportunities, have tourism along the shoreline, which looks very nice. Something I appreciate a lot about Jared Kushner is that he's very optimistic, and I like that a lot. I don't think it's a bad idea to develop Gaza necessarily, but it has to be on a strong foundation. And what I am skeptical about is the actual demilitarization part of the plan. I just don't think the Hamas is going to just hand over all of its weapons and allow some force that we still don't know who they're made up of to destroy all of their arms, stockpiles, and tunnels and things like that. I'm still pessimistic and think that there's going to have to be some sort of final act to this war where Israel's going to have to go in and do that. And at Davos, you know, I didn't go to America in the snowstorm, but I was virtually in Davos watching all of these speeches in snowy Switzerland. And Trump and Kushner and I believe Mladenov also all said that, you know, none of this can happen if Hamas doesn't disarm. And I'm glad that they said that, right? But there's still no clarity on how and when that's going to happen.
I think you're absolutely right that their intentions, that their President Trump, Jared Kushner, their team are very optimistic and their intentions are very good. And the plan is really quite ambitious. I think in the slides that Jared presented, he talked about their goal being by 2030, Gaza will have an annual household income of $13,000 per household. That's higher than Jordan. That's far higher than Egypt and Lebanon and Syria. That would be, you know, in the...
How about Palestinian Authority? Because they're actually pretty well off, right, compared to a lot of other Arabs in the region. Do you know?
I think it's still higher than the Palestinian Authority as well. You know, I think developments could happen over the next 20, you know, in over the next 4 or 5 years. But it's very ambitious. The other thing that I think is going to happen is that you have these development plans that Yair Gabay put together. But as soon as there's an attempt to start rebuilding neighborhoods, rezoning, redistricting, actually building, you're going to have Gazans coming and saying, oh, but this land belongs to me. This plot of land is mine. Here's my deed. Here's my ownership. And there's going to be very, very thorny issues of land ownership that are going to come to the fore and that may slow down, perhaps prevent this whole idea of reconstruction. Everybody wants to sort of get a piece of the action. I have to say, when I saw that video of the head of the National Committee for Administering Gaza, Ali Shah, if I quote correctly. So he said, I think it's something that was important. He said, we want to be judged by our actions, judged by our results, which I think is important. I think Palestinian leaders have generally tended to want to be judged by their rhetoric or by their terrorism, and much less by their actual actions to improve the lives of the Palestinian people. So I think that's an important statement. But how this committee goes from the right sentiments to actually taking away Hamas's arms. And it's not just, you know, there's most of the talk now is about heavy arms. Hamas with 20,000, 30,000 Kalashnikov rifles is going to be a major security threat and it's going to have the ability to upend stability in Gaza whenever it wants. So we have to make sure that demilitarization means demilitarization in the full sense.
You know, I think also going back to that Ali Shat video statement that he made to the sort of Board of Peace presentation in Davos, in Israel, some people were very angry because he had a Palestinian flag behind him. And in Israel, a lot of people sort of fixate on the fact that the Palestinian flag is the flag of the PLO, which is, you know, a terrorist organization. And then also the fact that he was a high-ranking bureaucrat in the Palestinian Authority. And I feel like people who say these things have unrealistic expectations, right? Like they said, the PLO flag is a political flag. It is not really a political flag, right? Like, okay, so Hamas, I think, is too extreme for the PLO. They're not like in the Politburo of the PLO, but like this is how they identify. And like, we're not going to, in this war of Gaza, somehow dismantle the Palestinian national identity that they've developed for themselves. Basically, since 1964, right? Or you could argue from the time of the Mufti, who also tried to do something like that, but they haven't completely changed as a people, right? And it's like people have certain unrealistic expectations. I don't think people in government do, though. But I'm talking about the more unrealistic expectations on the other end of things, right? Is that the whole idea behind the Gaza development plan is, like Kushner said, you know, everybody sort of wants the same thing, right? They want to be able to prosper. They want to have safety for them and for their children to grow and prosper, etc. And then our previous podcast guest, Ahmed Fuala al-Khatib, wrote a whole post on X about this plan. And he points out the importance of cultural differences, right? Which is, I think it's very American to think that everybody wants the same things, sort of, you know, like everybody has their version of the American dream. But that's not what the culture has been like in Gaza. And the cultural sea change doesn't just come because America is coming in and building nice buildings. The plan is often based on, or to a large extent, is sort of based on the idea of capitalism and free market and that people will start businesses and people will look for jobs, etc. And while I am all for capitalism and free markets, it takes, like I said, like a cultural change, and they haven't actually made that cultural change. They're a society that has relied largely on donations for decades.
And it's a society that, according to all available polling, still largely continues to support to think that October 7th was a good idea. There's some differences between the Palestinian Authority in Judea and Samaria and between Gaza. But I think it's probably likely that if elections were to be held today in the Palestinian Authority and in Gaza, again, according to all available polling, the largest party would still be Hamas. And as you said, we have to take into account those real differences, both in talking about the future of Gaza and the future of the Palestinian Authority, and to what degree Israel's interest is in continuing to hold up the Palestinian Authority.
By the way, this is a little off topic, but really interesting. Also from Ahmed Fuad al-Khatib, a couple weeks ago, he posted on Twitter that he had evidence of the main Palestinian polling place. I forgot what the group is called, but the pollster's name is Shikaki, that they, at least the people who do the polling in Gaza, have been like bullied by Hamas, and the polls are very deeply influenced by Hamas. Mm. So we don't even have reliable polls, apparently.
That's true. It's true. Last week we had on the podcast Isaac Yitz Applebaum, which was a fantastic episode, and we got a lot of really great feedback. And what was interesting was Yitz, who goes back and forth between the U.S., Israel, Saudi Arabia, the UAE quite often, was very optimistic about the future of not just Israel-U.S. and Israel-UAE cooperation, but Israel-Saudi Arabia cooperation. But at the same time, we're seeing more and more analysis and reports and evidence of Saudi Arabia taking an increasingly harsh tone towards Israel, towards the UAE, and even to a certain degree moving towards an anti-American, but signing a defense pact with Pakistan, talks about new defense pacts with Egypt, with Somalia. And I think that's something we should talk about is what is the future of what might be causing this, and what does that mean for the future of Israel-Saudi relations? Now, there are some who have posited that this is a result of the relative the disappointing results of part of the Crown Prince, MBS's vision for 2030 vision, is mega projects. I was looking at some interesting data. For example, the goal of the national investment strategy of Saudi Arabia aims to bring foreign direct investment into Saudi Arabia from about $4.5 billion in 2019 to over $100 billion in 2030. And according to the latest data that's available from 2024, they managed to bring in, I think it was about $31 billion. Still an impressive growth, but very, very far from this goal. Their goal was, I think, to bring to about $103 billion. So again, impressive growth, but still far from the goal. I saw another evidence. The goal was to build this mega project, the line in NEOM, and to have it be 170 kilometers long. According to the latest reports, it's planned to be 2.4 kilometers long because of all kinds of planning issues and budget issues and just not being able to realize this vision. Now, whether it's that's leading the leadership of Saudi Arabia to adopt an anti-Israel tone as a way of sort of reverting to that classic tactic is a question, but I think it's an interesting question.
I think there's actually a lot going on there. I think that's part of it, right? That he tried, you know, this whole 2030 plan and NEOM, which is like this whole futuristic city, and all these other plans that have not worked out for MBS, right? It comes also when the U.S. is seen as an increasingly unreliable partner, right? Like it was this flip-flop from Obama to Trump to Biden to Trump. And a lot of the warming up of relations between Israel and Saudi Arabia was really encouraged by the U.S. And the U.S. had hoped to make some sort of defense deal with the Saudis, and that as part of that deal, the Saudis would normalize with Israel. But they, first of all, it seems like that the Trump administration would be willing to make a deal with them even without normalizing with Israel. But also just that they don't see the U.S. as much of a reliable partner. And also just the Saudis and Israel find themselves on like different sides of a lot of regional issues, right? So on Somalia, Somaliland, Israel's the only country in the world to recognize Somaliland. And the Saudis were instrumental in organizing like a condemnation by many Arab nations. I think it was like a dozen of that recognition. And then in Syria, the Saudis were like among the first to back Ashara, right? They brought him out to Riyadh to meet with Trump, I guess it's like a year ago now. So, you know, there's a few different things going on. And then also with Iran, right? the common wisdom, like around the time of the Abraham Accords, was that the Gulf states minus Qatar, I guess minus Kuwait also, like Israel, because Israel, you know, is pushing back against Iran. Israel was the only country speaking out against the Iran deal. But there's an interesting theory that I find compelling, which is that the Saudis saw there being sort of a regional balance, like as long as Iran is relatively a pariah, but is strong, they have this balance of power in the region. But that, first of all, that Israel has really destabilized, like by attacking Iran, Israel and the U.S. attacking Iran, they've destabilized the regime. If that regime falls and a new one rises, the likelihood that it's just going to be Saudi hegemony in the region is slim, but what could happen is that that could end up being the large Middle Eastern state that the U.S. and Israel favor, right? So it could throw the region out of balance away from Saudi Arabia. So these are a few considerations, I think, that the Saudis have right now. And of course, they're mad at the Emiratis for numerous reasons, including some of the ones that we've already mentioned. And the Emiratis, of course, are, you know, there are Abraham Accords partners, so they also use Israel as a cudgel against the Emiratis.
It's interesting. There's long been economic and geopolitical competition between the UAE and Saudi Arabia, but it really seems to be escalating into outright conflict that we saw the most clearly in Yemen, but also in other arenas between the UAE and Saudi Arabia. And I think it also has to do to a degree with the UAE's growing accomplishments and growing confidence and how that impacts Saudi Arabia, which sees itself as the leader of the GCC. I think ultimately, Saudi Arabia, there's talk about Saudi Arabia and Turkey growing closer together, Saudi Arabia, like you said about Iran. I think there is a fear. There definitely is a discourse among, I think a misplaced discourse among some Saudi analysts and commentators that Israel is now unchained without Iran, that Israel, you know, wants to become a regional hegemon and take over natural resources and capture more and more lands. I think that's a misplaced. I think Israel is just clearly defending and ensuring its key security interests, but it's not looking to take over the Middle East in any way. But I think that ultimately, Saudi Arabia and Turkey may cooperate for tactical reasons. Saudi Arabia may prefer in the near future, a weak but stable Ayatollah regime, perhaps. I think ultimately the long-standing distrust and divisions between the Turkish Ottoman Empire that's now also being led by somebody who identifies with the Muslim Brotherhood, and of course the Sunni Shia and the Saudi-Iranian tensions, which run very, very deep. I think ultimately Saudi Arabia does not see itself as aligned either with Turkey or with Iran in the long run. I think that's unlikely to happen.
Yeah, but right now they're really promoting the same kinds of messages that the Muslim Brotherhood has been putting out there, you know, which is, of course, I mean, the Qataris are the big promoters of Muslim Brotherhood, but of course, Turkey is also run by, you know, Erdogan, who's of the Muslim Brotherhood. So it's really something to be worried about. And they're also on the same side as Turkey when it comes to Syria.
Now, Syria is becoming a really important issue. We President Trump seems to have a very, very positive view of Julani, the Syrian leader. And there are reports of a lot of pressure on Israel to withdraw from the peak of the Hermon, to withdraw from the buffer zone, the territories within Syria that it's now holding, in return for an agreement, for promises from Julani. And I think that could be very, very dangerous. We know Julani comes from an ISIS background. He is an Islamic extremist. He may be put on a suit. He said some nice words. He may be pragmatic right now. We don't know if the leper has changed his spots. We don't know if he's really changed his views. And even if he has changed his views, his base is still very much drawn from those radical Islamists. And, you know, based just on promises and pieces of paper and a handshake, for Israel to give up these, the peak of the Hermon, which is a critical, both vis-a-vis Syria, also vis-a-vis Lebanon and Hezbollah, the idea that Israel would withdraw and give up its sort of very real, tangible, and critical security assets in return for essentially promises or a signature on a piece of paper from the Julani regime, before the Julani regime has even really been tested, I think would be very dangerous and would be a mistake. And at the Miskav Institute, we've counseled many of the people that we talked to, decision makers on all sides, that Israel should remain in these buffer zones and on that Hermon peak, certainly until we have real proof as to whether Julani has changed. In fact, whether he'll remain in power in 2 years from now, or whether there'll be some other regime.
Yeah, and I also think that people don't take seriously enough, like not the U.S., not other countries in the region, Israel's commitment to defending the Druze in Syria. And it's very clear that Jalani Ashara, whatever people want to call him, that he's best case scenario not protecting them, worst case scenario actively supporting or sending out troops that are affiliated with him to attack them.
The other big news this week has been Iran and the reports and the footage of what looks like a massacre that the regime carried out against the protesters, reports of up to 30,000 people killed. And besides, this, I think, being a proof that it's time for regime change, that it's time for that to bring down this leadership. I think it also emphasizes, what we've dealt a lot with the criticism against Israel over the last several years, the hypocrisy. If you look at the outrage and the Greta Thunberg coming on a ship around Gaza, but then silence where, according to reports, the Iranian regime murdered, massacred 30,000 people in the span of a few days. I think that's also indicative of how the world looks at different conflicts.
Yeah, I mean, you see all these pictures people post online of like the Columbia and the Harvard campuses just like empty of people. Nobody is protesting. And we don't see Greta Thunberg getting on a ship. It's no Jews, no news, apparently. And people love these conspiracy theories that this is just whipped up by the Americans, by the Israelis. And it's like, just because something would probably be good for America and Israel doesn't mean that we did it. Like, they've been oppressing their people for almost half a century, and they've had it. Like, it's for the past, 25 years or so, 27 years, I think it is. Like, there's been like sporadic rebellions in the streets, right? Like every few years. What they need is for one to stick.
I think they've been showing incredible courage, incredible bravery, the Iranian people. Really, it's unbelievable when you look at, when you compare them to the protests on, at Columbia, at college campuses, these sort of, demanding humanitarian aid while they're hanging out in the Columbia faculty buildings, if you recall. And then you look at these real people who are really putting their lives in the line as they're being mowed down by the regime. It really is quite incredible. And I think we can only hope that the Iranian people are successful in their attempt to shape a better future for themselves.
By the way, the woman, that like infamous video from the Columbia protests of the woman who demands humanitarian aid, she now is apparently the leader of this unionization of Bread's Bakery in New York. Bread's Bakery. Yeah, so Bread's Bakery it's a bakery called Lechamim in Tel Aviv. It's like a small chain. There's three or four of them in Tel Aviv, and they're amazing and delicious. And then they opened in New York, I don't know, like 10 years ago or something. There's a few of them in New York also. So now their workers I think it's like actually a really small percentage of their workers are trying to start a union, and they've demanded in the union that they distance themselves from like anything that has to do with Israel. But the owners are Israeli. Like the chef is, the head chef is Israeli and the CEO is Israeli. It's just like completely nonsensical. So good luck to them.
It's actually a good segue to our guest this week, Arsen Ostrovsky, who is known not only for his international legal defense of Israel and for his work for Israel, for the Jewish people, and as being a survivor of the Bandai attack, but also for being somebody who enjoys a good breakfast and puts the videos and photos of his breakfast on social media for everybody to see.
That is true. But before that, this is the Miskav Institute for National Security's Mideast Horizons, the podcast for anyone who wants to understand what's happening in the Middle East beyond the headlines and spin. I'm Lahav Harkov, your co-host, a Miskav Institute senior fellow and senior political correspondent for Jewish Insider.
And I'm Asher Fredman, executive director of the Miskav Institute for National Security and a visiting fellow at the Heritage Foundation. The Miskav Institute is Israel's leading national security policy center dedicated to strengthening Israel's security, its regional cooperation, and its international standing and alliances. Each week here on Mideast Horizons, we cut through the noise, the shallow slogans, the tweets, to bring you fresh insights into the most important issues on the Israeli and Middle East agenda.
Please subscribe and follow wherever you listen to podcasts to keep up to date. And you can reach out to us with comments and suggestions at MideastHorizonsPodcast@gmail.com.
And we read your comments, so keep sending them. And we really appreciate your feedback. This week's guest is Arsen Ostrovsky. Arson is a leading human rights lawyer and head of the Sydney office of the Australia, Israel, and Jewish Affairs Council. He's a survivor of the recent anti-Semitic Bondi Beach attack, which we'll get into. He's also a senior fellow at the Miskav Institute for National Security, and we're very happy to have him as part of our team. Arson is formerly the CEO of the International Legal Forum and has been named by the Jerusalem Post as one of the top 50 Jewish leaders in the world. So without further ado, stay tuned for this wide-ranging conversation with Arson Ostrovsky. Arson Ostrovsky, man, it's great to have you on the Minutes to Horizons podcast. It's great to see you. And we've been friends for a long time. Obviously, when the news started coming out about the Bondi shooting, right away we were all very worried. And then we saw those pictures, the dramatic pictures of you lying on the ground, blood gushing out of your head. We were even more worried. But it's great to have you here on the podcast and to see you alive and well as always.
It's good to be here with you guys.
Arson, I thought we'd start, take a step back. And you know, people know you from your public activity, from social media, from your activity in the legal sphere. But just give us a little bit of background, your own personal background. Where were you born? Where did you grow up? When did you come to Israel?
So I was born actually in Odessa in Ukraine, then still Soviet Union, to a family of refuseniks. And we left or we fled in 87 to Australia. Actually, to Sydney, and to be more specific, I grew up in Bondi. So I grew up on this beach, so I know it very well. This is my beach. This is also my community and my people in so many ways. I'm blessed to have, you know, blessed to be, to belong in a number of different, I suppose, communities and places. Bondi is something very special. It's where I grew up and where I lived for most of my adult life until making Aliyah about 13 years ago, 2012. So the last, you know, 12, 13 years is most of the time, which I think you've known me, you both have known me during that time. You know, Israel's been my home. It's been where I've lived, where I've worked, where married and raised children. So I certainly did not expect, you know, certainly not in the last 2 years since October 7th, to come to Australia of all places and to be a part of what we saw in Monday on the Hanukkah festival. I should add, perhaps, you know, before we actually moved back to Australia, my kids, my oldest, who was about 8 years old then, you know, when we said we're moving, she said to me, "Abba, does that mean no more boonies? No more. Rockets and sirens and dashes to the bomb shelter." You know, this is a kid who had put her flip flop sort of swim mangle by the door, knowing that if there's a siren in the middle of the night, then this would be the fastest way to put her flip flops on so we get down to the shelter. So I said, no, sweetie, there's no more boonies. This is Australia. And I feel in some ways that I you know, let my daughter down in that regard. You know, what we saw was obviously horrific things, which resemble the Middle East, resembled what we saw perhaps on October 7th, the Nova Festival especially. It's not meant to be, you know, the Bondi Beach, probably one of the most iconic landmarks in Australia.
Could you tell our listeners a little bit about your experience that day?
So this... Every year for Hanukkah, Chabad in Australia, Chabad in Sydney, put on this beautiful Hanukkah festival, always on the opening night. And for many, many years, they've been doing it at Bondi Beach. And we had come there. We actually just moved back to Australia maybe 2.5 weeks just prior. And we went there as a family, you know, my wife and our two young daughters. We went there as a family, and there were children, there were elderly, there were families, there was face painting, there was a petting zoo, there were clowns, and it was just a beautiful, joyous festival, as Hanukkah festivals always are, whether that's in Australia or Israel or anywhere else in the diaspora. And just before the ceremony was about to start, my wife and children wait to sit down, and I just moved aside to get some food, and which is when the attack happened. The way it first happened, I thought, It might have been like a balloon. No, you're at a Hanukkah festival. There are children's activities, all sorts of stuff. So I thought it must be a balloon. But then it was relentless. It was bang, 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 like in nonstop. And it was absolute chaos. You know.
And how far away are you from the shooters at the time?
At that time, I'd say maybe not more than 70 meters, maybe less. There are multiple shooters. So one of the shooters was firing from a footbridge and the other one was firing from, in the beginning anyway, from by the parking on the street. So what it meant was that they were firing from both angles, and where the event was, it was a sort of the circular area at a park. And it meant that in a lot of ways we were like sitting ducks. And people started running straight away. People were picking up their children, running with them. People were falling on their children to shield them with their bodies. You saw smoke billowing from the grass, from the bullets that were firing. And, you know, I immediately ducked a little bit to my left where there was a little picnic area. But my first thought was my wife and kids, they're not them. Yeah. I've got to get them. So I stood up and tried to run towards them. That's when I got hit. And at that moment, I knew something had happened because it was like the best way I can describe it, it's just someone opened a faucet and the blood just started gushing out. I fell to the ground and I think I yelled, I'm hit, I'm down, need help. But no one could help you because everyone is down. And no one could get up. No one could get to you. On the right of me was a man, an elderly man who had given me took his shirt and gave it to me to help stem the flow of blood. Because when I put my hand on my head, I could already feel the flap of my skin. And when I looked at my hand, it was covered in blood. On the right of me was another elderly man lying on top of his wife, clearly protecting, shielding her. But he was motionless. His hand was hunched over and it was just dripping with blood, drip, drip, drip. On the left of me, there were two people who had been shot. And one of them, I could see a bits of body parts in his jaw. And at this point, I still don't know if my wife and kids are alive, if they're okay. I tried to call her. I couldn't reach her, which is when I took a picture of myself. And that's the one I think you might have referred to now. And I took it for two reasons. One was to see how badly I was hit. And two, it was to send to her with the words, love you, not knowing if they were going to be the last two words I sent. Oh no, and probably it would have been about 10 or so minutes after that I had finally heard from her that they were okay. They had escaped towards the water, towards the beach itself.
Just to clarify, so at the time that you sent her that picture and those words, you're still lying on the grass and there are still gunshots going off around you.
Correct. It's still, there's still bullets. Firing nonstop. There are people yelling in agony, and there are others who are trying to provide help. And I heard one of them, maybe a meter or so next to me, saying, "Leave him. We can't help him. There's nothing we can do." So it probably would have been about 10 minutes when that happened, and then when I finally heard that my wife and kids were okay, and they would have. Only later, found out actually ran right past me without knowing exactly where I was, or knowing that they would have run right sort of in line with the shooter's range, and he would have been in an elevated position picking people off. It was only then, and this is something that only recalled after having someone else experience, that I recalled I started reciting the Shema. Now, I am not the most religious of of Jews. And I can't exactly tell you what perhaps compelled me to do so, but I think in many ways it was probably the knowledge that, yes, my wife and kids were safe, no, out of harm's way. And whatever else happens now, I'm at ease in some regards. And then obviously the rest is, I'd like to say history, but perhaps some bad history, but obviously there's a lot that followed after that, and getting to the hospital and the whole process after that as well.
We were saying before, friends with Arson, but also good friends with his wife, and we were, all of our friends here in Israel were just like furiously texting, what's going on, what's going on, what's going on, until we realized at a certain point that we were probably getting in the way and being annoying, but we were all so, you know, on top of it, and also just so worried. It just like brings me back to that day. Then thank God, you know, just to see you, and before we started recording, to see your wife and in one piece is just, thank God. But we want to ask about, I guess, the context in which this happened, right? I know Australian Jews had feared maybe not this specifically, but they were worried about a tipping point in anti-Semitism. Can you talk a little bit about what the government had not done at that point, and also if you think anything has really changed since then?
So, you know, I think for a lot of Jews in Australia, this the gravity and the jarringness of the attack was obviously very shocking, but it wasn't surprising in many ways, and it follows on the back of at least the last 2+ years since October 7th, where the country has seen this unabated surge and explosion of anti-Semitism. Now, the 2 days after October 7th and October 9th, there was a mob that marched on Opera House, chanting. At first, we thought it was chanting, that they were chanting, gas the Jews. But then police said, no, it was just, where are the Jews? As if that's somehow any better. By the way, it was only just a few days ago that we're back at Opera House, marking, this National Day of Mourning for the victims of Bondi. So there's a lot of ways, you know, it's 2+ years, but in many ways, it's sort of trying to reclaim places like Bullets in the Opera House. But it really, you know, this attack did come in the back of over 2 years of repeated warnings, warning after warning after warning, that when this hatred goes unchecked, when it's mainstream, when it's legitimized, when it's excused, that violence will follow. And we saw this deadly manifestation on December 14th. Anti-Semitism is not, it's no longer on the margins here. It's really entrenched and pervasive in everyday society. You know, hardly a day or a week goes by here in Australia where we didn't hear reports about synagogues being firebombed, Jewish schools being graffiti, Jewish businesses being boycotted, individuals, including children and elderly, being attacked, marches across places like the Harbour Bridge, calling to globalize the Intifada, the government here recognizing Palestinian state or singling Israel out for repeated opprobrium, you know, only perhaps pouring some more fuel on the fire. And so this was the inevitable, I think, result of over 2 years of repeated failure to heed the community's pleas and warnings that something will happen. And sadly, we saw them on the 14th, 15 people losing their lives. You asked me if something has changed. I believe, yes, it has. And we saw that in a response after this. Now, this attack didn't just happen in a synagogue or in a secluded area. This was in Bondi Beach, which is like one of the most iconic landmarks in the country. No one goes to Australia without visiting Bondi Beach. And now there are two things I would say. One is what I would choose to take out of this attack is not the heinousness and the evil shown by the perpetrators, but the way everyday ordinary Australians showed just the most incredible courage to run towards the fire, to give aid, to provide comfort, which was something incredible. But that didn't stop on December 15th. This has kept going every day. And we saw that with the calls for the Royal Commission, which is, for the American listeners, kind of like a Senate investigation, perhaps. But we saw people from all across the full cross-spectrum of society, from business leaders to sports leaders to security experts to former politicians and to lawyers to educators, pulling for a commission, because they understood that, you know, we need to know not only what happened, but how it happened, and to draw the appropriate lessons so that it does not happen again. So whereas I think so often in the past, and it's perhaps something, you know, it's similar to any diaspora community where anti-Semitism is rife, people tend to look at it as a Jewish issue. And I think people here finally understood this, that anti-Semitism is not merely a Jewish issue. It's not a left-wing or right-wing issue. It's an Australian issue. And that when you single out a member of the community, when you have Jewish day schools and Jewish aged care homes with security guards and police, something's not right. When you talk here now about the fact that Australia, there's a whole big debate last week about the adoption of this bill on hate speech. Now, when you're talking already about the need to codify and legislate against hate speech, there's something deeply, deeply broken in the society. The fact is, we do need that. But it's something deeply broken when there is a need for that. In the same way as when my kids go to school, there's, you know, there's three layers of security. Now, no other group has that in the country. So I think people are finally understanding that an attack on any one member or any one group of society is an attack, as if it's on a nation as a whole. So I think that that has changed, and we've seen that in the debate and the conversations we've had since December 14.
Arson, you spoke about what's changed in Australia. I know we've known each other for a long time, and I've always been really admired your courage and your activism for Israel, for the Jewish people, against international legal bias and attacks against the state of Israel. When you moved to Israel to take up your new position in Australia, it was to take a leadership position with the local Jewish community. I wonder, what if anything has changed in your worldview, the way that you see your own personal mission, or, you know, your goals vis-a-vis Israel, vis-a-vis the Australian Jewish community, vis-a-vis the broader community since the shooting? You mentioned that you had said Shema. Have you found yourself praying more since then? I wonder how it impacted you as a person.
I feel like, you know, that's the pre-December 14 and post-December 14. It's like so many ways, like we felt, you know, pre-October 7 in Israel and post-October 7th. So this is almost, you know, a second or a third lease of life now. You know, I probably should not be speaking to my very survival is a miracle. That's what the doctors said themselves. It was a millimeters between life and death. And I can't explain to you why I survived, but a 10-year-old girl did not, or an 87-year-old Holocaust survivor who saw the horrors of the Shoah is not here today. I can't tell you why I survived. What I do know is, and the way I look at it today, is that survival to me comes with a sense of responsibility. Responsibility to share what happened, a responsibility to honor the victims and the survivors, and the responsibility to only reinforce our mission, our duty in combating and fighting this scourge of anti-Semitism in all its manifestations. And, you know, I'm very much used to being on the other side. I'm used to advocating for survivors. I'm used to sharing their stories. I'm not used to being a survivor myself. So it's a very different perspective. But I think does provide a very profoundly personal mission now in doing the work we do, and the work, obviously, we feel very much, whether it's in Israel or Australia.
Well, you moved to Australia to work for AJAC, the Australia, Israel and Jewish Affairs Council. Maybe tell our listeners a little bit about what you've been doing for them, what they've been doing. Sort of, I know it's a pro-Israel sort of advocacy organization. And a lot of the anti-Semitism in Australia is what we've been seeing for a long time, not just since October 7th, which is that people sort of disguise their anti-Semitism as anti-Zionism. So how does all of this play into what you moved to Australia to do?
Well, I should say that I probably started work a couple of days late. I did apologize to them, but I did have a pretty decent excuse, so to speak. Look, I mean, working with AJAC here is, you know, I actually started my life in the professional Jewish community at AJAC some 15 plus, I think, years ago now as a policy analyst. So in a lot of ways, it's coming back home here. But they are probably one of the top organizations here in the country that serves as a public affairs organization, but also as an advocacy arm for the Jewish community. And the combating of anti-Semitism is something that's obviously very central to those efforts, as is strengthening the relations between Israel and Australia. And the President Hodisovich visit is coming up shortly as well, and they bring a lot of groups to Israel, from really everyone from politicians, journalists, policymakers, interfaith groups, and likewise bring people here as well. So I think the work had already been cut out, you know, in terms of the load of work before this now, but obviously it's taken a whole new sense of urgency and mission purpose now with the questions of how do we move forward? How do we turn what happened on December 14 into some kind of like transformational turning point? Because if we don't learn from the past, as we know, we're doomed to repeat it in the future. So we have this amazing opportunity now to take the devastating experience that we have just gone through and learn from it, and to draw the lessons and to understand not only what happened, but how we as a society, talking about DNA as a government as well, allowed it to happen so that it does not or cannot happen again. And the Zionism element, as Kanki mentioned, love, is something very critical to this discussion. It's very easy to say, you know, well, someone's a neo-Nazi, or, you know, they want to ban Jews. That's easy. Easy to call that, but the anti-Semitism under the sort of the masquerading under the cover of anti-Zionism can be far more difficult, especially in today's arena and so many of progressive circles where anti-Semitism has become so pervasive there and entrenched. We've seen that at writers' festivals. We've seen that in the business arena and online, obviously, as well, where, and including, by the way, the two attackers who carried out the Bondi shooting actually also invoked the "we're doing this for anti-Zionist purposes," if that's somehow any more appropriate. Of course, it's not. So I think that's going to be part of the discussion moving forward as well, when we're talking about hate speech, which we really are serious for here. We're talking about outlawing different groups who participate in this kind of speech. I mean, in terms of addressing what are the root causes and drivers of modern anti-Semitism, we have to also be very clear that it stems not only from the far right, from the far left, obviously to the radical Islamist sphere as well, but it does also stem very heavily and increasingly so in a very pervasive and dangerous manner from the anti-Zionist arena, where people sort of use it as a shield to hide from their own anti-Semitism, which we know only leads to violence, only incites further hatred, and people cannot be allowed to but to a bit away. So we find a way to call that out and to incorporate that in a manner that still, you know, doesn't impede on free speech, but does recognize that some forms of speech and actions can and do lead to violence, as we've seen here.
Arson, following the shooting, you received phone calls from Israel's President Herzog, from Israel's Prime Minister Netanyahu. This is a little bit of background of those calls, and what did you tell them on those calls?
So I probably shouldn't go into the specifics of what I or they said. Look, first of all, I deeply appreciated those calls, and the Speaker of the Knesset called Amira Hana called as well, and even Namihai Shikli, the Dutch Prime Minister, he actually caught, I think, the first plane out from Tel Aviv and came to see them, actually saw me in hospital as well. So I think that those conversations were deeply meaningful, and including with the President and the Prime Minister as well. Look, they were incredibly sincere and honest, and first and foremost expressed their solidarity and their concerns, and underscored, of course, the need and the urgency to tackle anti-Semitism. What I appreciated specifically about receiving these calls was the fact that there really is, I think, this, you know, we say Israel is a Jewish state, but we sometimes find it difficult to express how perhaps that might reflect itself. And I think this is one of the ways, recognizing that, yes, Israel is a Jewish state. Yes, we are responsible in so many ways for one another. And that when Jews are attacked anywhere, it is as if Jews are attacked everywhere. And that includes inside of Israel. And just as obviously the diaspora community here in Australia, which is one of the most fervently Zionist and proudly Zionist communities, has stood so much of Israel since it took. Here you have obviously a mass terror attack, and the leaders of Israel actually expressing solidarity and support. And I would add also sending a lot of support staff as well, including trauma experts, obviously, that have seen and had not far too much experience in Israel, but our experience that here is certainly very deeply appreciated in a country that has not had a need and for that. So that was certainly very, I think, very warmly accepted and appreciated.
You know, you were talking about Australia being a deeply Zionist community. It's also known to be the community with the highest proportion of Holocaust survivors in the world. And also, as a side note, I mean, like, your family's story is sort of like a lot of families. They were very welcoming to Soviet Jewry as well. So a very special community. But going back to the topic of Holocaust survivors, because we're talking right before International Holocaust Remembrance Day, and we've been talking to you about Australia, but I think you have expertise and experience dealing with anti-Semitism, and especially legal defense of Jews in Israel in the face of anti-Semitism all around the world. I was wondering if you saw this news report that the number of schools in the UK that are marking International Holocaust Remembrance Day is now half of what it had been before October 7th because it's too politically controversial. And just how you think Jewish communities should be responding and sort of raising the alarm at this time.
It is deeply, deeply sad when the study of the Holocaust is deemed somehow as controversial, or that it may offend someone's feelings. Perhaps this is history, and if we don't learn from it, and then the will repeat it, as we've seen time and time again. You know, I think there are two things I would say. Now, one is that we need to, and especially as you know, the International Holocaust Remembrance Day, which specifically marks the liberation of Auschwitz. We also have the Jewish people have Yom HaShoah, but then there's the International Holocaust Day, which marks Auschwitz liberation. I think it's important to underscore that the Holocaust did not begin with the crematoriums at Auschwitz or the gas chambers. That's where it ended, where the life ended for so many Jews. It began with the demonization of a group of people, Jews, with singling us out, with dehumanizing us, whilst so many otherwise ordinary, decent people stood by. And we've seen that, I think, in the last number of years as well. But instead of the Jewish people being singled out, instead of the Jewish people being stripped of our rights and dehumanized and delegitimized, it's the Jewish state now that is undergoing this. While so many otherwise, again, ordinary individuals or leaders have either stood by or excused this or poured more fuel in justifying this and behavior, and which is why I think it also falls upon falls upon decent people, those who have a sense of moral clarity, to call this out. The other point I would add is, specifically talking about Holocaust education, it's Holocaust denial today is, I think, very much on the fringes, albeit still disconcertingly high. But Holocaust distortion is, I think, growing rapidly, which is very, very disturbing. You know, Holocaust cinema has become universalized today. You know, it almost, when everything is a Holocaust, nothing is. It diminishes not only the memory of the 6 million Jews murdered in Holocaust, but also those that have suffered in wars subsequently as well. The Holocaust is a very unique event in history, specifically with respect to the Jewish people, 6 million Jews that perished. But today, seemingly everything is a Holocaust, and that, I think, not only is an inversion of history, but also an inversion of truth. It diminishes history, it diminishes the memory of those who perished, and I think it presents a very dangerous worldview today of events, whether it's with respect to what's happened in Gaza or elsewhere in the world, there is cause for discussion about the gravity of what is happening, but the fact that the Holocaust today is somehow deemed controversial because it may offend others is deeply, deeply problematic.
You're well known as somebody who's very active online in the social media space. And one of the notable developments right after, essentially, I guess, as you were in the hospital and being treated, was all these AI pictures, which were getting hundreds of thousands, maybe millions of views, which were claiming that the shooting was just an act and showing you as if you were makeup being put on so that you could take part in this act. Maybe just a little bit about what that was like. Well, first of all, on a personal level, seeing those pictures, and then more generally, what you think needs to be done, can be done, to counter online anti-Semitism, Holocaust distortion, especially given this debate that you've also taken part of recently around the Australian legislation around free speech and censorship. So what are your thoughts?
I received these AI images and news of them as I was literally about to be wheeled into the operator theater with the bullet fragments still lodged in my head. Which is when I received these images, and you know, I obviously knew straight away that they were fake, not least of which because one of the images, I think the guy had six fingers. But anyway, my initial reaction was not to dignify this campaign of lies and hate with any kind of response. You know, if anyone that's written, dealt with the Middle East for, spent, you know, 5 minutes online, even less, as obviously the two of you have, you know, that we're also dealing in not just the physical warfare, but information warfare campaign as well. And so this isn't a shock in some respects. It is a shock, however, when it's you at the center of these images. But I think it's easy to just dismiss them. But on the other hand, we have seen, including here today, including now, what happens when these kinds of, you know, deep fake AI campaigns and fake news stories are allowed, permitted to proliferate unchecked, because there are too many gullible people out there who will take this at absolute face value. And we've seen what happens when these kinds of campaigns are left unchecked. They lead words to, can and do lead to violence, to action, to incitement, to the kind of events that we saw in December 14. And this does, you know, I think, raise for, you know, what is the role of social media companies as well? You know, these images, with respect to me, they flooded Twitter, Reddit, and other social media platforms, Instagram as well. Now, social media companies, you know, they know very well how to deal with fake news. They know very well how to deal with algorithms to ensure that not only this kind of material does not or is not allowed to receive the space on my platforms, but then when it does, if it does get through the cracks, to ensure that it does not mushroom to something bigger, to somehow minimize it or to flag it or to even remove it or take it off. Certainly in the cases where there is legitimate security concerns, I think, as there is here. So you have the role of social media companies. Now, the reality is social media companies are not ones necessarily self-regulate. So you have the question, okay, what is the role of governments perhaps in this as well? Now, Australia is very different to America. In America, you have first speech consideration than the Constitution. Australia and in many parts of the Western world are different. So it does offer perhaps a little bit more leeway for social media companies to take action. But one thing is certain is that, you know, the whether it's the extremism that we've seen across the world, including ISIS, which these two terrorists were inspired by, or whether it's actions that we see online, including through these deepfake campaigns, through AI, through fake news stories like this, they wield enormous power to radicalize people, to incite violence. And I think that's something that needs to be very much looked at, not just by the social media platforms, but perhaps by the regulators and the governments as well.
You know, you're talking about how the laws in Australia are different from the US. And I know that Australia just really limited children's access to social media. And also in the past, they wanted to try to get social media companies to have to pay for news that was being put up on social media. Is there something that Australia or any other country you think is doing right that you could tell us to try to stop the spread of anti-Semitism? But also there's just a lot of crazy conspiracy theories and really damaging things that go around on social media.
Look, I can't tell you who's doing it right. I can only tell you that so many are not doing enough. This is a problem that's not limited in geographic locations. Australia, we're seeing it in Europe, we're seeing it in the US, we're certainly seeing it in the Middle East, we're seeing it through the likes of Al Jazeera and some of the social media companies and AI tools being promoted, whether it's through the Chinese or the Russians, Qataris, the Iranians as well. So I don't know who's doing it right because it seems too many are doing it wrong. The Australians, at least in the last weeks, so in the last week, passed important hate speech legislation as well, which kind of goes in part towards this, including outlawing certain groups that engage in hate speech in circumstances where it would fall just short of terrorist actions, but would be deemed engaging in hate speech. So there are sort of things that can be taken, but ultimately I think, you know, you can have all the laws in the world, as I think a lot of Western nations do, and certainly Australia did before December 14, but in the absence of political leadership and willpower to enforce laws are meaningless. So we talk about all the different laws in the world, but I think it's just as important that we also talk about the need for lawmakers to actually enforce these laws.
So I just tell you, you know, you and I we had breakfast together the morning that the Abraham Accords were announced. I still remember that. And then in the weeks and months following the announcement of the Abraham Accords, you and I were very involved in bringing together a large group of Israelis and Emiratis and Bahrainis for interfaith dialogue, for getting to know each other. And this group, which still, you know, still exists, the people are still together, has been much quieter over the last couple of years during the period of high intensity war since October 7th. And then the day when we started getting the news that we saw those horrible images from Bondi Beach and the very, very scary images of you, all of a sudden this group came to life and everybody was, you know, asking how's Arson doing and, you know, condemning what happened and sending their heartfelt prayers for you and for the welfare of all the people all the victims of the attack. And I think that's a really, you know, it's a point of light, one of the many points of light from this event.
Look, 100%, you know, even after October 7th, some of the first messages I received were from some of our mutual Emirati friends saying, are you okay? And, you know, that's something that I've certainly never forgot. And likewise, you know, the days after December 14th, going through So the many, many messages and well wishes were many from friends from the Emirates and Bahrain and the Abraham Accords countries. And I think that's something incredibly special because this is a relationship that has really been tested through some very difficult times. But we had always maintained open communications and respect for another and have had conversations throughout. And the thing is very simple as getting to know one another forget the politics as individuals, as human beings, which has been incredibly special. And I think that's really testament to a lot of the work that's been done on our grassroots people-to-people level that obviously I'm sure you do day in, day out as well, and the Misgard Institute as well, likewise. So I think that's something that's important because it tests, it's something that has stood the test of time through some of the difficult days and also the good days as well. And that's obviously very, very meaningful and appreciated. And I think, you know, it's something that that does provide a sense of hope for the future as well.
Arsa, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. I know it's not easy to have to drag this up and talk about these things all of the time. We really appreciate you being here, and I think our listeners will as well. Mm. We wish you the best of health and just the best to you and your family, and keep fighting the good fight.
Thank you so much, and I look forward to getting breakfast soon again. I don't know how the Australian breakfast compared to the Israeli breakfast, but
they have good coffee.
they do have good coffee as well. But I do miss my Israeli breakfast. That's for sure.
Thank you for listening. Make sure to subscribe, like, and follow Misgav on social media. And of course, visit www.misgavins.org. And you can send your comments, questions, and suggestions to MideastHorizonsPodcast@gmail.com. And we'll be back next week.